taking you inside the book world.
You're back on Pia Lindstrom Presents on Sirius XM Book Radio.
I'm Pia Lindstrom, and I'm with Jonathan Hayes, and we're going to talk about cutting up bodies, because Jonathan Hayes is a former, no, I take that back, not a former forensic pathologist and medical examiner, but a contemporary forensic examiner.
That's correct.
And novelist. His first novel, Precious Blood, was called a brilliant debut, a hard-boiled procedural that cut to the bone. Jonathan Hayes, welcome. I hadn't realized that you were still practicing forensics and writing these novels.
Well, I suppose I'm fairly lucky because I love both of my careers. And I have enough time when I get, the days can be fairly long, but at night when I get home, I shower and I sit down and I write. It's a busy life.
I should say so. Now, Dr. Jenner here, you have Edward Jenner. He's your alter ego. Right?
I wouldn't call him my alter ego, but he's my protagonist.
He's your protagonist.
He's a lot better looking than I am. But we share some of the same character flaws, endless self-pity, a tendency to brood.
Well, what sort of a person goes into forensic pathology?
That's a loaded question. Very nice, smart people go into forensic pathology. Well, it's funny, the field has changed very much in the last decade or so. And I think one of the main things is that it's become a lot more glamorous with the advent of shows like CSI and Bones. We have a huge influx of fresh blood, and I think this has been great.
That's a funny expression. Okay. But all right.
Well, you were so zesty with cutting up dead bodies.
Yes,
there at the beginning.
I got you in the mood here.
But there's great young people coming into the business now. I think in the old days, I think it used to be more of a marginal profession. Pathology in general as a branch of medicine tends to be fairly marginalized. People assume that people go into pathology because they're not able to deal with living patients. But that's not true at all. And then even in the subset of pathology, forensic pathologists tended to be even more marginalized because they were the people who couldn't deal with anyone. But that's changed. And then the fact is that on a given day, I spend a lot of the most common joke you hear as a forensic pathologist is, well, at least your patients don't talk back to you. But the fact is, we spend so much time talking to people. We talk to families, we talk to cops, we talk to lawyers, we speak to juries. So a great amount of time in our profession is spent speaking. And if you can't deal with other people, you're not going to make it as a forensic pathologist.
Of course, you're dealing with crime and murders, not just autopsies on people to find out why they die. But in your book, A Hard Death, he's looking for clues.
That's exactly right, and that's what we do. I think, of course, the glamorous side, or what's seen as the glamorous side of our work, is the crime and the murder. But we fulfill a important public health service in terms of monitoring disease and, you know, detecting disease outbreaks, but before they've really come across the radar of the public health service. I think that's a very important aspect of what we do. But of course, it is the crime, the murder, the more lurid stuff that attracts a lot of attention. And it is fascinating indeed. I mean, it's one of the reasons I went into forensic pathology. I'm very interested in how the world works. And I think the forensic pathologist has a certain angle, has a certain perspective on life that we're fairly privileged to see. We understand the way people live, and we understand the way people die in a way that most people never understand.
Your character, Dr. Jenner, you say, has had a train wreck of a career in the first book.
He's basically a classic flawed hero. He was a forensic pathologist and a good one working in New York City. And then during the problems after 9/11, it was a very difficult process for him, and he made certain errors, and which became compounded and became a political issue, and finally he got burned out and quit. And so my first book, Precious Blood, opens with Jenner kind of a burnt out recluse, refusing to get involved with the world, letting the rest of the world go by, and in classic thriller form, he gets dragged out of retirement by a beautiful young woman who's being threatened by a serial killer. So Precious Blood is the story of Jenna, who's a burnt-out forensic pathologist chasing a serial killer through the streets of post-9/11 New York.
Well, now he finds himself in Florida.
Yes.
Why Florida?
Well, things didn't go too well for Jenna in Precious Blood, and his license to practice medicine ends up getting suspended. So he gets a part-time job working in Florida. It's just a several-month covering job for an old mentor. And the reason I chose Florida was because I trained in forensics in Miami. I did a one-year fellowship in forensic pathology, which was just an insane experience. It was the end of the cocaine wars, and my life there was just so beyond bizarre that it's really hard to even imagine that it actually really happened. I mean, I'd get flown out by helicopter into the Everglades in the middle of the night, and then I'd get taken back to my car, and I'd be driving back to Miami. You know, we'd pull a body out of the swamp and examine it, the scene, and then I'd drive back into Miami at 4 o'clock in the morning, and the radio turned up high so I could stay awake. And then I'd get to the main drag, Ocean Drive, and there'd be models in bikinis rollerblading down the main drag, you know, high on cocaine. And it was just, the whole city just seemed so wired. And of course, because I was new to forensics, it was, everything seemed so much more intense, so much more kind of hyper real. It was kind of an amazing experience.
There's also something sweaty, creepy, hot, steamy, depraved about those Everglades. There's a whole genre now of Florida noir.
Well, I didn't realize there was a whole genre of it, but yes. I think A Hard Death fits into that nicely. While I was working in Miami, I was also spending time moonlighting as a forensic pathologist covering in Naples and on the West Coast in Collier County. And I don't know if you know Naples, but it's a lovely town. It's quiet, it's charming, and it's a resort mostly for the elderly and not for the elderly, but for older people and for the affluent people who can afford to retire down there. And so when I was working in Naples, it was very much small town crime, small town cases, nothing, very little in the way of violent crime. But then one day I got called up to a town for migrant workers about 50 miles north of the city to investigate a stabbing. And the difference between the opulence and the luxury and the air conditionedness of life in Naples and then the squalor of the way people were living in this farming town was just astonishing to me. And this contrast between the wealthy and the powerful and the destitute and the weak was just really stayed with me. And that formed the kernel of what would go on to become A Hard Death.
I'm Pia Lindstrom. I'm talking with Jonathan Hayes about his book, A Hard Death. Well, your first chapter is fabulous. I mean, that is one of the more frightening first chapters.
I don't know if that's a nice thing to
yeah,
say.
Yeah, well, it is. Well, it makes you go on to the second.
Well, that's a nice thing to say.
And then you already have like four murders by the end of chapter three.
The book, it's a fairly intense book. And the way I write, I have a very visual imagination. I care a lot about how things look. And I'm not a cerebral writer. I'm a sensual writer. I care about how things smell, how things sound, how they feel. And so when I write, I try to recreate for the reader what it's like to be doing my work, what it's like to be kneeling down over the body of a murder victim in the middle of a swamp.
In the muddy, steamy, sweat.
It's miserable.
Infested. You're but the way you describe it, I mean, I've not been there, but I'm just, that was the impression I got.
It can be really horrific. I mean, South Florida, I mean, let's face it, New York is a filthy, squalid swamp in the summer. But in Florida, it can be crazy.
But there have been so many books set in New York, so I think we have to get out of setting them in New York. They need to go somewhere else. Florida seems like a good place for.
I think it is. The next book, the next Jenna book, Monster Park, takes place in the mountains in Colorado. So it'll be a fresh
change of pace. The pristine mountains are going to have all these.
The pristine mountains are going to get dirtied up, I think.
That's Jonathan Hayes. We're talking about a hard death. One of the subplots in the book is migrant farm workers. Did you see some of these incidences yourself or have a personal experience of the deplorable way in which the farm workers are treated?
Yes, I have. And of course, I think we're all aware of it. Any of us, you know, if you just have to read the newspapers to understand that in every country, really, not just this country, there's a real spread between the wealthy and the powerful and the poor and the desperate. And I think, of course, the poor are always vulnerable. But when you have an immigrant population, and says he, an English immigrant, when you have an immigrant population, they're particularly vulnerable. They have really no recourse to maltreatment. And so sometimes, and I'm not saying this is the case in all of, you know, the agricultural business in the South, but the conditions there can border on slavery. And even in Precious Blood, there are a couple of scenes which touch on the lives of immigrants in New York City. I have a Chinese delivery man who's carrying feathers when he's attacked by a killer. I don't think most people realize just how close, particularly in New York City, how close we live. In New York City, you can have some of the wealthiest people in the world living next to the poorest. And sometimes in death scenes in New York, you can go into these apartments, and the squalor, the conditions that some people have to live in are just Dickensian. Mm. We haven't come that far from the Victorian age, I think.
Well, that's Jonathan Hayes, Dr. Jonathan Hayes, I must say, who is a forensic pathologist, still working. That's his day job. His night job is writing successful novels. You have a couple of love interests. There's a good girl and a bad girl. Do you find it easy to write from a woman's point of view?
Well, it's complicated. I think of course, I'm going to get murdered by my female friends for saying this, but I understand some women fairly well. I think I relate fairly well to many of the things that women are dealing with. But I don't know. You're probably a better judge of that, whether I do it well.
Well, only because when I did read it, you have a good girl and she's very good. And you have a bad girl and she's very bad. And I thought, don't you know that we're all mixed up?
Yeah. Oh, please. Yeah.
We're a little good and we're a little bad. we're not.
me,
it's not so easy to tell either.
me included. But the female characters in the book, I think I did kind of polarize them fairly extremely. But I think that's part of a noir tradition, and I think I'm okay with it. My next book, Monster Park, has a female character who I think is really strong, and I think who may eventually become a spin-off character.
You also have a very foul-mouthed TV anchor woman. Is that someone you knew?
No, she is inspired by a certain legal expert who appears on one of the major cable networks.
Would you like to name her?
I don't know if I should. I think.
Oh, she's not listening.
Okay. Well, Nancy Grace.
I find her
very upsetting. I don't think she's a force for the good. She's a representative. She, you know, if this were a Frankenstein story, she'd be down there with the pitchforks and torches leading the mob. There seems to me to be a complete rush to execution, and there's no sense of due process or justice in that.
That took care of Nancy Grace. Now, your villain, I have to say about your villain, he's also pretty one-sided. This is the worst person. He's decadent, sadistic, rich, cruel, has almost incestuous, almost incestuous relationship with his daughter. I mean, where did you find that within your creative mind?
This character was inspired by, I read a piece in the Village Voice about a wealthy Floridian businessman who fell in love with his daughter and actually took her to England and married her there. Oh. And so he was an inspiration for this character. And then there was another inspiration for the character was a pornographer, a very notorious pornographer named Max Hardcore, who's, I think, currently in prison because of the films he made. And I fused them to make a thoroughly reprehensible man.
When did you start writing?
As a child, I wrote stories. When I was about 5 years old, I wrote a book. I wrote and illustrated a book called There Once Was a Sailor Who Went to Sea. I don't really remember it very well. And tragically, it's lost to time. But I've always liked to write. And then when I moved to New York and became a medical examiner, I pitched a story, an expert witness review of the movie Silence of the Lambs. I'd been invited to a screening of that. And I contacted Premiere Magazine, a movie magazine I loved. And I asked to write about that. And they assigned me the job. And I wrote an awful, terrible, awful piece on it. It was really, it read like a William Shatner monologue. But it was a fun experience. And then when I moved to New York, I joined a local online community. And I was talking about my experiences at restaurants and at the movies. And a magazine editor from this small, trendy magazine called Paper Magazine contacted me and asked if I'd like to write for them. And I thought I was very flattered by that. And so what I did was I wrote a roundup of my favorite Vietnamese restaurants in New York City. And they loved it. They called me back and said, you can write about anything you'd like to write about for us. So I asked if I could write a monthly column on the music and culture of the rave and the nightclub scenes, the electronic music scene at the time. And so I wrote this column called A Higher State of Consciousness for a couple of years. And that was really fun, except it was exhausting because on some days I would do an autopsy in the morning and then I'd testify in a murder trial in the afternoon. And then I'd go out to dinner to a restaurant I was reviewing because I continued writing about food. And then I'd go to bed, sleep from 10 to 12 and then get up and have a little disco nap and then go out all night, you know, dancing with friends. And then I'd write about it. And I wore out of that quite quickly. But luckily, my food writing was getting a bit more attention. And then one day, Food and Wine magazine called me up and asked if they could send me to Las Vegas to write about the developing food scene there. So I wrote for Food and Wine, and then someone from Martha saw that, from Martha Stewart Living saw that, and asked me if I'd like to write for them. And I began to write for them frequently, and then Gourmet and New York Times, and it just sort of spread out from there. But I have to say, I mean, the cops always used to joke about it. They'd say, Dr. Hayes, he spends his days with the dead, his nights with Martha Stewart Living. But I loved writing for Martha. I loved the product. I thought the magazine was fantastic. I loved the stories. And you'd write these little essays And they share the same sort of values that I do, sort of authenticity, integrity, local ingredients, fresh and in season. And it was all so beautiful. And particularly in the period after 9/11, when I was having some problems, you know, with the work I was doing at the time, I would spend the day, you know, working in my office. And we in the time after 9/11, we were doing 12-hour shifts, and it could be exhausting because we were doing that on top of our normal work. But then I'd come home and I'd have to sit down and I'd have to write about edible flowers. Or I remember one particularly surreal day. I was just exhausted. I came home and I had to write a piece called Nutcracker Sweets. And it was all about dainties and delicacies and confections for Christmas themed to the Nutcracker. And, you know, I remember there was an almond cake, which was a pine cone cake. It was in the shape of a pine cone. And someone had taken probably hours to layer individual slivered almonds on it to recreate the little boughs, the little elements of the pine cone, just to make this perfect pine cone cake. And the fact that there was this attention to detail, this sense of the value of beauty at a time when I was dealing with really horrible things, just kind of balanced out my life. So I think Martha saved me at some level.
I'm Pia Lindstrom, that's Jonathan Hayes, talking about forensics and food. I never thought of those two together. His book is called A Hard Death. We'll take a little break and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Pia Lindstrom Presents on Sirius XM Book Radio. We'll be right back. Taking you inside the book world. You're back on Pia Lindstrom Presents on Sirius XM Book Radio.
I'm Pia Lindstrom. I'm talking to Jonathan Hayes. His book is called A Hard Death. Let us examine the connection between the beauty and color and shape and moisture and texture of food. And then there you are with your scalpel, going into the moist, tender parts
of the
body.
You're rather morbid, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
But no,
have you ever thought that you said you were a sensualist, or that the sensual things appeal to you, color and shape and texture?
That's absolutely true, and I think that's why I did fairly well as a food writer, is because I care about those things, and I also quite care about, you know, the greater culture of food. I think there are a few things that represent a country as well. It's its food, the geography, the history, the culture. They're all expressed by the food. So that's particularly interesting to me. But at a central level, pathologists talk about food a lot. Because food and ingredients of food are a common language. So when you're trying to describe texture or the appearance, for example, people with heart failure may develop a condition called nutmeg liver. And so that the liver has the appearance of a nutmeg. Of course, these days, most young people don't know what a real nutmeg looked like. They've only seen grated nutmegs. But pathologists have always used food to describe pathologic conditions, because we all can relate to that. So bread and butter pericarditis is a inflammation of the lining of the heart, where it looks a bit like a buttered bread that's fallen on the floor, lifted up and has this little tendrils of butter sticking off it.
That's wonderful. I never thought of it that way. Were you ever squeamish when you approached a dead body that tongue had been ripped out and something awful had happened?
You're making me want to retire. No, my father was a pathologist. But the thing is, when you start
in London, where are you from?
I was originally born in Bristol. I was only born once, but that happened in Bristol in the southwest of England. But my family has been fairly migratory. We lived in Jamaica for the first 7 years of my life, and then in Canada for a year. Then we moved to suburban Boston. And when I was from the age of 10 onwards, I went to school in England.
So you were used to the conversation about pathology. Perhaps if your father
kind of, I didn't really pay much attention to it. I wasn't sure whether I wanted to be a pathologist like my father or an actress. My mother was an actress, and she'd been an actress on Broadway in the 50s, and
really?
Worked with Noel Coward and a bunch
of
other
name?
People. I don't know her stage name. I don't think her career was huge, but she did do some quality work. So that always sounded appealing to me. But realistically, I'm fairly pragmatic at the end of the day. In England, you decide what you're going to do with your life when you're 13, and then you commit to advanced study in just a few subjects. So I stopped studying English when I was 13 and just concentrated on chemistry, physics, and biology, and went on to medical school. When I first started, your first day in medical school, one of the first things they have you do is start dissection. And in England, where I went to, the hospital where I trained was founded in the 900s, so it's a fairly ancient, it's been upgraded since then, but it's a fairly ancient place. But on your first day, you start doing a dissection of the body. And back then, we didn't use gloves. It was just barehanded, kind of to desensitize you to the body. And I'd seen it a large...
Did you have an aptitude for that? You immediately said, oh, a body, goody.
I suppose I was a little freaked out at first, but it's so matter of fact that I got used to it. But forensic pathology was different because in forensic, you know, up until then I'd dissected it as a medical student and then operated on living patients. Scratch that. I'd dissected, you know, intact human bodies who died of natural disease, and then I'd operated on living intact bodies. But when it came to forensics, there you're dealing with bodies that are very frequently damaged. I remember, and that's something I've never really got over, the way a body can be mangled and torn apart, and it makes human life, you know, the integrity of the body seem like such an ephemeral thing. I remember one day I was talking with Maury Rubin, who's a pastry chef. He runs the City Bakery here in New York. This is about a decade ago, and he was saying, you know, Jonathan, we only talk about the food world. We never talk about your day job. Tell me, does it ever really get to you? And I said, well, really, Maury, there's only one thing that really gets to me, and that's brutalized, mangled bodies. I still find that really upsetting. And then about 10 days later, it was 9/11, and, you know, everything got changed. Mm. But when I first started in forensics, I first started seeing forensic cases up in Boston. It was often very disturbing to me because I saw decay for the first time, and the decomposing body to me was something of an aesthete, and to see how the body decays, the changes in the color, the bloating, and the smell, it was really, really upsetting to me. I would sometimes dream about it, and when I was in the room, I'd have to excuse myself sometimes and step outside and kind of pull myself back together. But I always went back in, and it took me a while to get over that. It took me probably 3 or 4 years. Where I actually had to before I could actually accommodate to the smell and to the sight.
So, what are you left with when you see so much death?
People always assume that forensic pathologists are a kind of a miserable, twisted bunch who have become jaded from seeing, you know, just the worst things that humans can be. But I feel differently. For a start, I still believe that humans are essentially good, and given the option of doing the right thing or the wrong thing, they will generally do the right thing. I also have a greater sense of the value of you know, every day, of every life, of every experience. It's like, oh, I'm blanking on his name now. Warren Zevon, when he was dying of cancer, he was on, I think, the Letterman Show. And he said the biggest lesson he'd learned was to enjoy every sandwich. And I think it's certainly true. I mean, it's a short thing and you've got to make the most of it.
Is there another book coming right after this? And are you doing it also with Dr. Jenner?
Not right after this, but there is another Jenner book coming. It's called Monster Park, and it's going to be set in the mountains of Colorado.
Is he going to get any older? Because I see that you're a friend of Linda Fairstein's, and her character doesn't get any older. Is your Dr. Jenner going to grow up?
I think in the grand paradigm of Bart Simpson, I think he's going to stay roughly the same age in his early 40s. we'll see. As I said, there's another character I'm going to be bringing in who's a crime scene detective who's had a kind of rough past, who's lost her son, and I think she may be a spin-off character. So Jenna may be put out to retirement, but I don't think he'll stay in retirement for long.
That is Jonathan Hayes. His book is called A Hard Death. It is a very exciting read, particularly the beginning, which will grab you, and you will hang in there till the very end. I thank you so much. I enjoyed talking to you and learning a little bit about cutting up bodies.
Thank you, Pia.
You've been listening to Pia Lindstrom Presents on Sirius XM Book Radio, Sirius 117 and XM 163.